From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we'll talk with Milwaukee Symphony's new music director, Ken David Mazur. Then our new series, Healthy Body Basics, gets underway with a very simple goal.
We want to teach people that there are simple tips and tricks and things that we can actually add into our everyday lives to make your breathing better, your standing better, how you move.
And rock and roll pioneer Todd Rundgren says once music became truly portable, things changed, and not for the better.
People started carrying the music with them. You're reading the newspaper at the same time while you're on the subway. You're jogging and thinking about other stuff, and the music is just there to set the pace for you. Suddenly, music is the wallpaper to your life. It's no longer a quality time experience.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. You're listening to Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North. The Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra is in the middle of a lot of change. Their new home on West Wisconsin Avenue is on track to open in time for next season. Frank Allman, the symphony's longtime concertmaster, recently announced he'll be stepping down after this season. And the entire organization has welcomed its newest music director, Ken David Mazur. Mazur is the son of German conductor Kurt Mazur, the longtime conductor of the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra. The younger Mazur began piano studies at 6, sang in the Gewandhaus Children's Choir from the age of 9, and graduated from Columbia University. He made his conducting debut in 2004 at the National Orchestra of France, and he's since conducted the San Diego, Munich, and Boston Symphony Orchestras, among others. Ken David Mazur joins me in the studio now and says it's wonderful to be in Milwaukee.
It's an extraordinarily exciting time for the orchestra, for the city, for the community, and meeting the musicians, of course. The music making was what I came for in the beginning. Told some people that at the time that I came, it wasn't clear to me that the orchestra was still looking for a new music director. So for me, it was, you know, like going to a guest week, focusing on some good music making. The program was very varied. I got to perform with the chorus and the orchestra and soloists from within the orchestra. We have, of course, extraordinary soloists in the orchestra itself. And so I was thrown into this beautiful, wide-ranging program from French to American to British music. And it was clear to me this orchestra can do anything. And it was so rewarding artistically. And then it was to my surprise that they said, well, would you even consider, would you be interested in, you know, coming to Milwaukee? I said, well, don't you already have someone? You know? So it was just a wonderful, very natural way of an encounter, of getting to know one another without pressure that you might have, you know, when you look for somebody new. And I thoroughly enjoyed myself. And then getting to know beyond the podium and beyond the stage, the great music making, which is what we live for, of course, to meet the people behind the scenes and to meet the people of the city and the management and the board and all of those who are involved in also the new building. And it was clear to me there's a true passion for what people are doing, a real commitment, not just to this project or this organization, but to what it can do and what it will do for the city. An understanding of where the city has been, where it's coming from, and where it can go. You know, the vision was big and it still is big. And so for me to be invited into this moment is thrilling, absolutely. And it allows me to be able to think freely and also artistically in ways that you don't always find in other situations. So this is truly a beautiful moment for us as an organization, for the orchestra, and also for my partnerships with the management and with my artistic partners at the symphony. It's been a wonderful beginning. We've already had some really, for myself, memorable experiences that we got to share with this great audience. And the audience seems to have really responded beautifully. And we feel just warmly welcome to the city, and we cannot ask for more.
Well, yes, you have a wonderful building, and that's something that the symphony has needed for a long time. I've been here just over 13 years, and having a home for the symphony was something that I think people always knew needed to happen, a permanent place. Mm-hmm. And now that it actually is, I think you're right. I think it does give you and the whole organization a freedom to kind of take a deep breath and just relax a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then be able to open up and even do more than what you've been able to do in the past.
And this is a special time also, and to be in the midst and during this period where you have so many ideas coming out. And of course, people, as they're being shared, the building and the vision and the plans and so on, you know, already all the creative juices are flowing, and and we're inviting, of course, these ideas and then looking as to what we can do with them. And of course, I will bring my own, and then, you know, my partners here, together with Brett Dorhout, the artistic administrator, and Mark Niehaus, the executive director, of course, of the symphony. There are so many great things to look forward to, and what artists will come and so forth. I mean, this will be not just a national, but I think an international draw, because this hall will truly be great acoustically, visually, historically. The atmosphere will be very unique because you have this combination of this old world, you know, feel, you know, with this extraordinarily beautifully preserved Art Deco core, if you will, of the hall. And then, you know, newly built parts to the building as well, with the lobby and areas where we can have other ways to engage the audience with exhibits, with panels, with talks and activities. And we didn't have that before. And also the fact that the symphony will own the building and find ways to engage other partners that way, I think, will be very unique. And there is this time now where we want to take a look from a bigger perspective, from a bird's eye view, and see what is this for the greater community that it's going to do, because we want everybody to feel that it's accessible, that it addresses them, that they can identify with it, and that while we look for all of these talents and artists to come from all over the world, they will want to come here. They will want to see. They're all curious already. And while that's happening, that we want everybody in Milwaukee, of course, to feel that this is their home and this is something that they can be proud of. And it's their identity right there as well.
It's their symphony.
Yeah.
Talking about the symphony musically, you mentioned earlier that you felt that the symphony was flexible enough musically to basically play anything. Is that rare in symphonies? Do symphonies kind of get locked into a particular, you know, genre or mode or way of doing things that the way the Milwaukee Symphony has presented itself to you is somehow unique or different?
Well, it's changed in the last few years in terms of what musicians are not just expected to do, but what they're able to do, what they're interested to do. Because the initiatives also for musicians to go beyond the orchestra out into the neighborhoods have risen because of the interest and because of the need and because musicians have looked for new ways to engage with audiences. And we want to represent an opportunity for all of the musicians, because we have musicians in the orchestra that have that natural inclination, this interest of connecting beyond just the symphony stage with people. And they're already doing it, you know, with chamber music or in their neighborhoods with engagements with not just kids, but a wide range of audiences. And we want to enable, encourage that, because all of these things and all of this music that we have, the richness of chamber music, which of course you actually feature here in your studios, is the basis, it's the nucleus for what we do on stage and, you know, the big concerts. And that is exciting for us to see with these kinds of programs that will draw people in. It is the intimate experience often that will hook someone, you know, when you're in somebody's home or when you're playing somewhere where people didn't expect to hear music. When we hear music, I mean, at least for me, this is true. Street musicians, they're not around here in Milwaukee yet that much. I haven't heard any. But if you go to some European cities, it's not true. Okay, I heard the American cities where I heard some either a random fiddler here or a bagpiper there. but in European cities, you have street musicians, you know, violinists who are either students or they play arrangements of the Four Seasons or of Sibelius Violin Concerto or Tchaikovsky. And we cannot help but stop when it's actually being played well, you know. So there's all the noise of the city and of the street, and then we stop because we're just, it's like, wow, you know, the noise is gone. And we're drawn in. And there is that immediacy that I believe is true for everyone, and that's universal. So we want to build on this universality that I believe is this holds true to people in Milwaukee as it does for people in my hometown of Leipzig in Germany.
I love that experience of turning a corner and suddenly there's Bach.
Mm-hmm.
You weren't expecting it. You weren't thinking about it. And there it is. And it sort of embraces you.
Yeah.
And takes you in.
You're moved. I mean, we build on these universal truths when we think of big productions, of course, in the New Hall, or big productions to close out the season, you know, with the chorus. And it's all the same, really.
What are you most looking forward to working on with the orchestra? Is there a particular composer or a particular piece that you think, I haven't heard them do this yet, and I want to work on that with them.
Mm. I'm, of course, imbued with sort of this, you know, heritage of the German tradition, like several, of course, of music directors that have come through with the Milwaukee Symphony already. But there is something that I feel strongly, you know, about continuing that line and everything from, you know, Bach to Schumann, Mendelssohn, Brahms, and then, you know, introducing the new generation of German composers with the first program we did with Detlef Glarnert, is important to me to continue that line. And then also, you know, I always look for surprises and to make music, not just in that direction, but making sure we get our vitamins, if you will, in that regard, but that the vocabulary of the old masters is expanded every time we do something new. That is the idea behind having, you know, new music or contemporary music or living composers on almost every program. If we look at, you know, most of the programs that I'm conducting this season will have something of the sort. And to me, that is very important that we pair it, you know, together. But coming from this German tradition, you know, and again, these experiences that I had as a child, you know, we can't shake those. And because those were very happy associations, those are the things we find the most natural to want to share with someone that you care about. And I care about this city and I care about, of course, this audience and knowing that they will love this music, but also to let them know when we introduce things that they might not know, that we do it like, let's say, some home cooking. When, you know, your mother cooks you a nice meal, you always expect it's always going to be your favorite dish, you know, but then she brings home maybe, you know, a different kind of salad dressing or, you know, a different dessert. And it's supposed to surprise you. You might not like it, but it completely changes your palate and how you can look at other things. You know, you completely open up the spectrum of your perception. So that to me is, and very often I use these analogies.
But it works absolutely because you might not like that dessert that one time, but maybe the next time
Yeah.
You like it a little better, and maybe you look for it the next time you think, you know, I had that taste once. And I want to revisit that.
Yeah.
And I think learning about, you know, contemporary classical music, at least in popular culture, has had a very negative, you know, it's like, oh, it's all thorny and it's all difficult and it doesn't invite me in. And that's not true.
Yeah.
But you need to be told that, you know.
Yeah.
You need to know that that's not true.
And the thing is it's the other thing, you know, the reason why I brought in the mother cooking is because, you know, she will do it out of love. When we program, we're not doing it out of spite, you know. We're not trying to dare you or challenge you. I mean, it is about us being open to new horizons always. I mean, this is the history. All of these pieces we're performing, doesn't matter if it's Bach or if it's Tchaikovsky or, you know, they were all new ones. And, you know, there are people who didn't like them, believe it or not. So when we bring in these, you know, this is going to be enriching for us because we are allowed to be there at the beginning, you know, at the birth of some of these things. And that is an extraordinary thing. Maybe, you know, they will survive hundreds of years after this world premiere that we might present here in Milwaukee. Maybe not. But the point is that we're on this journey together, and that we, I think, as human beings, our urges and our desires always to find something that will spark something new, that will keep us engaged, that will keep us curious. And whenever we are slightly challenged, it might be uncomfortable. At the same time, we are actually sometimes fortunate, I think, to experience that, because we know that we will come out on the other side a different person, a new person, a person with maybe a new opportunity to discover something about ourselves. That's what the programming is about. That's also what the new partnership ideas are about. You know, when we talk about programming that brings in visual partners or actors, you know, for programs at some point to do anything from Midsummer Night's Dream to Peer Gynt and, you know, those kinds of stories. Yes, of course, we will have the staples of, you know, Beethoven's Ninth and, you know, Brahms' German Requiem and other things. But the idea is we want to experience stories together. And every program is like a menu, but also has a narrative to it and something that we feel is not just us from the stage dictating or lecturing the audience, but the audience needing to know we value wherever they come from. They don't have to come prepared. They don't have to bring a set of facts that they know or statistics, as, you know, a lot of people like in sports, or, you know, they like to know all the statistics and things, but to just come as you are and let it happen to you, which sometimes I find difficult. You know, I think that we all like to have a certain level of control as human beings. You know, it doesn't matter if it's about, you know, driving in your car, how fast you're going, or, you know, or going shopping. When you're in a museum and you see things that you like and don't like, you can decide how long you're going to spend in front of an artwork. With music, it's slightly different. To see the whole picture, you have to sit from beginning to end. But a certain level of surrender, if you will, is what I always ask myself to have if I want to really experience the music and if I want to really experience the moment. You know, my father used to say very often and remind me, the 2 hours that we get people into the concert hall, at least for 2 hours, we have world peace for those people there. And I bring this up, and it's not just a small idea for me, but, you know, having grown up in Leipzig, which was, of course, in East Germany at the time, and being a member of the Gewandhaus Children's Choir and seeing people gather for Monday demonstrations in 88 and 89 that would finally lead to the reunification, which happened in, basically, it started in Leipzig, the whole movement of people having peace prayers around the city with candles, and then it grew to basically 60% of the population being on the street in October of 89, and we're actually coming up to the 30th anniversary of that. That's big, not just for Germany, but I think for me, personally, it has informed how I look and value music, music making, and also venues, because the Gewandhaus at the time became the first venue where freedom of speech in East Germany was exercised. It was opened like an embassy where people, because people of the city, they knew they couldn't go anywhere and speak their mind. They would be followed and, you know,
arrested.
And the churches were trying to be a, you know, safe place and a safe haven. And there was one particular church and pastor that was Pastor Führer, who was very instrumental in that, in this whole movement, into, you know, which would then turn into this movement of the peaceful demonstration for all. But then the Gewandhaus was one of the most important places where it was opened up for these talks. And my father would, you know, be there with a panel of other leaders that he would trust. And he would say, we all vouch with our lives that you will not be arrested for the opinions that you're offering at this discussion. Unheard of, you know. And this was in the venue that stands for art and music making. And the reason is that people started to trust the leaders in the arts more than the politicians, you know, more than any other civic leaders. And so I want, you know, to never lose this understanding that we are privileged that through our music making, we are given a level of trust by the audience, that we have something important to say, that we will use that, and that we will use that to be responsible, not just with our instruments and not just in the moments that we're on stage, but with the venue that we're now building. You know, that venue is supposed to be a safe haven for at least thoughts and for the imagination, and a place where it's open for discourse and dialogue, and for, where people can come in and feel replenished and recharged when they leave.
Ken David Mazur, it is such a pleasure to have you here in Milwaukee. Thank you so much, and I look forward to many, many, many opportunities to have that replenishment and that ability to have that peace in that moment.
Thank you so much for having me, and I look forward to many, many conversations with you also.
Ken David Mazur is the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra's newest music director. His next performance with the symphony will be in November with a concert of Beethoven and Schubert. Take a deep breath. Coming up in a moment, we'll premiere our newest series, Healthy Body Basics, and breath has a lot to do with it. You are listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. We are back with more of Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. We kick off a new series today. Healthy Body Basics is co-produced by Lake Effect contributor Cynthia Akey, who's a certified yoga instructor, a personal trainer and a wellness coach, and videographer Lucian Jung. The series will offer tips and tricks to help us breathe better, stand better, and move through our lives a little easier. We should say up front that none of us are medical professionals, and you should always check in with your doctor before beginning any kind of fitness regime. That said, to get things started, Cynthia sat down with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to explain the thought behind the series.
Cynthia Akey, welcome to Lake Effect. It's great to have you in the studio.
Well, thank you, Audrey. It's nice to be here.
So give us a little background on yourself. How did you get into health and wellness, not only for your own practice, but helping other people?
It actually started with my own aches and pains, really. So coming to fitness a little bit later in life, yeah, you're always doing walking and a little bit of exercise here and there, but nothing that was more connected or more formal. And coming from a place of pain, seeing a chiropractor 3 times a week, dealing with headaches and all kinds of posture issues, how to make that better as you age. I mean, the biggest thing is how do we make the body as comfortable as we possibly can be? And just found a lot of different techniques. Chiropractor took me to gym, taught me how to do some strength training specific to back health. And from there, a friend said, hey, let's go to a yoga class. I'd never been to a yoga class. I've been trying a lot of different fitness things, trying to find the right fit. And that one was the one that made the big aha moment for me and said, this makes sense for my body and how I can actually both strengthen it and stretch it at the same time. From there, 2 years after taking yoga classes, I got into wanting to actually teach it and bring it to other people, saying if it's helping me this much, I could help other people find that same sensibility within their own body, that build that awareness, knowing simple things that they can do to take care of themselves. And yeah. It just kind of evolved from there. So now we're 15 years later as doing it as a side, originally as a side gig, and 5 years ago going, changing careers and taking this on as being a wellness professional and trying to help people every day.
Well, that's so important because none of our bodies are perfect. We're not feeling great at any point in time.
No, we definitely are not. I mean, and it's unfortunate. Like if you're waking up with a backache or you're carrying something too heavy in your day, or just how you're sitting at your desk, if you're a desk dweller, knowing that there's different ways that you can actually change and improve that.
Right, and it doesn't need necessarily an acute injury or some big, you know, life event to spark this kind of change in people. And something we're trying to do here, so this is the first of what will be monthly segments. And listeners might already be familiar with the Fit For You segments, but that's more about formats, different trends. This is a monthly segment about how we can improve ourselves, you know. So can you get into the goal of what we want to do with this?
I think we want to teach people that there are simple tips and tricks and things that we can actually add into our everyday lives to make your breathing better, your standing better, how you move, teaching people better ways and proper ways to actually do simple tasks, things that will improve activities of daily life. Everything from when you're having a stressful day, how you can do a breathing technique to change and calm that down. If you're doing repetitive tasks, gardening, raking, how can you actually do that a little bit healthier, safer for your body? So thinking about structurally how we can actually change that for the future.
And giving tools to do so.
Absolutely. So a lot of just exercises. So we'll be working on just some tips as well as some exercises, strengthening exercises, stretching exercises, as well as some breathing techniques.
So for our first month of Healthy Body Basics, it's all about improving our standing posture. So what do we need to improve and especially be conscious of when it comes to our posture?
Well, typically we tend to stand with not a lot of awareness of how we're actually standing in our bodies. There might be some tightness in shoulders or low back, and just starting to be aware of those areas and how we can actually change those for the better. So things that we are seeing typically when we are with this device-laden world, we tend to have our heads down, our shoulders rounded. We're getting a little bit more strain in our upper backs, which then puts more strain into our low backs with the head posture forward, so that whole text neck issue. So it's impacting the health of our spines, as well as it can impact our balance. So if you think about your heads down all the time, your balance is now shifted way forward, and we may not be countering that with using some abdominal engagement just to help support the spine. And again, that collapsed chest is going to make it difficult, more difficult to breathe. So we might feel a little bit more anxious because we're not getting as much breath into the body as we should.
And it's more than, you know, making sure you're not hyperextending, say, your knees or anything like that. Because does true standing posture, you know, it's total body. You mentioned
it's total
core
body.
And back.
Yeah, absolutely. So it comes from the ground up. So we've got to start with our feet, being aware of how we can stand a little bit more actively in our feet, being kind to our knees so we're not locking into knees. Considering the tilt of the pelvis, which, again, we've got a natural curve and a neutral curve going on there, and trying to find where that neutral curve can be to actually help support your spine a little bit better. Bringing in some abdominal engagement, some shoulder, just a little bit of contraction just to stabilize the shoulders. Because of that rounded forward posture, we need to tend to draw those shoulders back and down just to help open the chest, to help lengthen the spine through the thoracic region.
And ideally, this helps prevent further injury in the long run, you know, from going from an ache and pain to, oh my gosh, I need to see a doctor.
Absolutely. I mean, just these simple movements, and they can be done anywhere from standing in the grocery store, sitting in your car. Like I always tell a lot of my yoga students and all of my fitness students, just adjusting your rearview mirror can be something that encourages you to maintain that tall posture. So sitting tall, and as soon as you can't see in your mirror, you know, like, oh, I'm not sitting up. I need to be a little bit taller, put a little bit of energetic intention into sitting a little taller and using some of the muscles along the spine to help stabilize that.
I do notice in the morning I need to adjust it up so I can see better. And by the end of the workday, it's like, oh, readjust.
Right. Because you're like, oh, what just happened to my body?
Exactly. And outside of the aches and pains, you know, what can bad posture indicate in someone's body outside of, oh, perhaps they're not correcting it as often as they should? Deeper things?
There could be other issues. There could be just other dysfunctions that are within the body. Could be just some structural things that are happening. So that might mean getting some other doctors involved to see if there is some other things going on there. Everything from feet to shoulders and hips. Just knowing that there is always someone that is out there to help you to find the right solution for your body.
Now, with good posture, you mentioned we can adjust things in the car. What are some quick tips and tricks? I was thinking about, you know, lately Amazon has been selling those posture correctors, the straps that you put on your shoulders, which is basically a reminder.
It is. You know, and it's funny because two of my sisters actually have scoliosis. So I'm a little bit more, you know, aware of spine issues. But she actually had, like, in the process of going through the whole scoliosis process of having a brace and different shoulder things. And I do remember her wearing something like that. And other people have actually talked to me about, like should I look at getting one of those? Is that really going to help me? And I said, if it's a tool that's going to help remind you to engage the muscles, then yes, I would say do it. But if it's something that you're using it as a crutch, it's not necessarily going to make the most impact for your body. So instead, if you can actually encourage the body to find that correct position on its own and find that sense of strength and stability from within, you're just going to serve your body so much better in the long run.
And we do have an instructional video, tips and tricks of how to improve our standing posture, which you can find at wuwm.com. And Cynthia, thanks for coming in today, and I look forward to the other segments to come.
So do I. Thank you so much, Audrey. I appreciate it.
Lake Effect contributor Cynthia Akey is a certified yoga instructor, personal trainer, and wellness coach. She and contributor Lucian Jung produce Healthy Body Basics for Lake Effect with help from Audrey Nowakowski. The tips and tricks Cynthia mentioned are at WUWM.com, along with a video that demonstrates everything she talks about. A reminder that you should always check in with your doctor before starting any fitness regime. We will take one last break and then catch up with rock and roll icon Todd Rundgren ahead of an appearance here next week. We'll bang the drum all day, or at least during the rest of Lake Effect, when it returns on Milwaukee's NPR. We're back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Any Packers fan worth their salt knows that tune. The guy who wrote it, Todd Rundgren, has been making music for more than 50 years. The multi-instrumentalist had hits of his own like Hello, It's Me and I Saw the Light, and he produced seminal albums for Badfinger, Grand Funk Railroad, The New York Dolls, and Meatloaf, among others. He's also a champion of music education, and he runs a foundation to help bring it back into public schools. Rundgren will be here next week when a tribute to the Beatles' White Album comes to the Pabst Theater. We reached him at his home in Hawaii, and he joins us now. Todd Rundgren, it is an honor and a pleasure to have you on the show.
No problem.
And of course, you know, we're really fond of one of your songs here in Wisconsin.
I wonder which one.
I don't know which one that one might be, but you're not going to be playing that one, are you, on this concert?
Well, I only get two songs, and they kind of decided which songs they wanted me to play. It's the same kind of situation as with Ringo, where you play a couple of your own songs and then the rest of it is the Beatles in one form or another. Yeah, I'll be doing Hello, It's Me and I Saw the Light. No big secret.
No big secret on those, no. But of course, we are all fond of Bang the Drum.
Yeah, that's it's also my least favorite song to play.
So it's a good thing they told you not to, right?
It's just a bunch of yelling and jumping around.
Yeah, it's a young man's song, right?
Yeah, when I was younger, it was a little bit more fun, you know, but at this point, it's just, I often dread it when I have to pick up the timbale sticks.
Well, we won't make you do it. But you're here, you mentioned Ringo, and you're here in kind of celebration of the 50 years of the White Album. And
I think we missed it by a year. I think it's 51.
Is it 51? Okay, well,
yeah.
Okay, we can't add.
It was 50 years ago last year.
Last year. But you're here to celebrate that album and to participate in that concert. And so what was it about the White Album that made you want to be part of this?
Well, I'm up for doing all of these kind of collaborative things. They're fun tours to do because, the burden isn't all on you. It's spread out. And both in the, in the performance sense and also in, bearing the expenses of a tour, all you have to do is just take your salary,
You just show up,
So it just makes it a lot easier. You're well taken care of usually, and so as a playing experience, it's always easier in some ways, and often it's fun because you're getting an opportunity to work with other players and interact with them. Sometimes you even become influenced by them, and that's ultimately, what musical experience is supposed to be, absorbing other influences and not getting stuck in one place.
Well, and you've got a really interesting group of guys to be playing with on this, too. I mean, those are some really interesting, diverse experiences to bring into the group. I mean, I'm looking at the list. Jason Scheff from Chicago, Joey Mollen from Badfinger, Mickey Dolenz from the Monkees, and Christopher Cross. I mean, it's like you're kind of all over the place in your own individual careers. And it's just interesting that this group is together.
Yeah, well, when the producers go out and canvas, for artists for these things, it's always, somewhat complex formula. First of all, you have people who are inclined to do it. Second of all, you have to find people who are skilled enough to do it. And thirdly, they have to be available to do it, not doing something else. So it's very tricky, to put together five personalities of any particular professional level, get them all, free of their other commitments, have them all be, competent enough to do it, that sort of thing. So it isn't simply the names. You have to have a sort of guaranteed skill set within that group of people, and I believe that's certainly there. The trickiest part, again, was getting everyone free of other commitments.
Had you played with any of these guys before under other circumstances?
Well, I've played under similar circumstances with Christopher Cross in a tour that was called A Walk Down Abbey Road, and the production team behind it is the same as this. So they kind of make something of a practice of trying to find events in the Beatles' career and then duplicate them in the present. So, yeah, I have done that. I have not worked with with Mickey before, and I have not worked with Jason, but I have, of course, worked with Joey on Straight Up with when Badfinger was young and spry.
Right.
So that was in the 70s, and we really haven't communicated since. So we're virtual strangers to each other as well.
Well, that's going to be interesting to reconnect after all of this time. And, of course, Badfinger was supposed to be, an answer to the Beatles.
Well, they were, signed by Apple. And they did, in that sense, outlast the Beatles. So they could have been, kind of the inheritors of the Beatles' legacy, in a sense.
You've been doing this a long time, both as a player and as a producer. How have things changed in the rock and roll world? I mean, we all know that like live has to be the way people make money now because nobody's making money on albums because everybody downloads it for free off YouTube. But how has that changed the music making, or has it?
This all goes along with the evolution of the delivery system, of the way that people get the music. And there's, you know, upsides and downsides to all of this. The old model essentially involved, the old model, the commoditized model, where you're buying a thing, an LP or a CD or something like that. That sort of depended on a certain amount of control over the audience. The high price point, you know, made people more selective in terms of what they bought. High price point due to the fact that the actual manufacturing costs of the product were relatively low compared to what it costs to get to buy the product. But that also created in the mind of the listener or of the music consumer a greater value in what they had purchased and a greater commitment to listening to it and actually getting that the maximum value out of it. What's happened now that music has become ephemeral, it's now a service, it's not a commodity. It's ridiculous for anyone to buy a song for 99 cents, and I've always said that. If you're going to have subscription services, then have subscription services, but trying to have some sort of hybrid, you know, commodity, but it's actually a downloadable and that sort of thing, you know, that's sort of ridiculous. But the byproduct of that is, there are a couple of byproducts. One is that because the music is so easy to consume and seems to cost so little, people don't value it as much. What they value is the latest thing now. So it is less and less an art form and more a consumable item. And a byproduct of that is a lot of people who claim to be musicians, but making music is only a sideline of marketing their personality overall. So I think in the minds of a great deal of music consumers, and maybe it always was this way because most people don't study music. They either enjoy it or they don't. In the minds of most consumers, they do not get attached to any particular piece of music because there is so much music and because something new is going to be begging for your attention tomorrow. It won't be like the old days, you know, where records only got released on certain days and in certain months and things like that, you know. Yeah. It was all planned around getting people into a record store so that they would buy not just the record they were waiting for, but other records as well. None of that exists anymore. And so the end result is that most of the people making music pretend to take it seriously, but do not. They just as soon be designing shoes or hats or somehow influencing people and getting paid essentially for doing nothing. So that's the state of music nowadays.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Having said that, you know, the upside of the ephemerality of music and the ease with which people can get it is that there are still people who really like good music and will search it out and will commit themselves to listening to and understanding it. It all changed as soon as the Sony Walkman came out and people started carrying the music with them. Suddenly, it's not a quality time experience. You're reading in the newspaper at the same time while you're on the subway. You're jogging and thinking about other stuff, and the music is just there to set the pace for you. Suddenly, music is the wallpaper to your life. It's no longer a quality time experience.
Yeah, and unfortunately, I think that's true, and it just...
Well, there's no way to stop that.
Right.
You know, but the point is, it makes the technological, all this technology that we put into music seem sort of superfluous in a way, because it's returned things to the original model. The model where the only way you can make money as a musician was to go out and play music, because there was no such thing as records at the time.
And so
now it's back to virtually the same thing. You can only make money as a musician if you go out and play music. Now, the people most affected by this in the long run are songwriters. If you're writing music but you're not playing it, you're in a much different position, and it's much harder for you to collect.
Yeah, and to make a living. Yeah, it's like we're back to minstrel times. You know, you have to go out, and the band has to perform, and the people have to pay, you know?
Exactly. And if you wrote the song for that band, but you're not playing in the band, how do you get paid?
Right. The band's going to be like, wait.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's to some point there will be statutory, you know, every gig you play, some amount. Either the promoter or you are going to have to pay some amount to the copyright owners of the material that you play.
It is a very different world from when I first heard you, and you know, and the White Album, and a lot of these other folks. I remember listening to the Monkees as well, and certainly Chicago. And it's like, you know, here we are in 2019, and it's such a different place.
Well, that's the way evolution works.
I guess so. Yeah, so there are times, and most of the time I don't like to look back, but, you know, there are times when I think, you know, there was just something so special about putting that album on in your room and really connecting with the music.
Yeah, but that's the thing about evolution. You know, there are, you know, new things being created, but things going extinct as well.
Yeah.
You know, things that don't adapt go extinct.
Well, fortunately, you seem to have adapted.
I have always been somewhat adaptable because I learned how to learn after I got out of school. Most people figure, you know, okay, I'm done school. I've learned everything I need to know now. You know, I'm going to get on with my life. I hated school so much that I learned almost nothing while I was in it. But as soon as I got out of school, I learned how to teach myself. I learned the way that I could, you know, discover things and retain them and prioritize them and that sort of thing. And I haven't stopped since.
Do you find having to reproduce an album or a song exactly the same way, does that take the spontaneity out of it? I mean, to me, part of the fun of playing live is you don't know exactly how it's going to happen because you're in the moment with the other musicians.
Well, that is the challenge, but when you advertise a reproduction, you know, you say, okay, we're going to play all the songs from this record in order, you know, and the way that you remember them, then it's essentially, in a sense, false advertising.
True.
Not to deliver what people remember.
Yes.
So there certainly is that element, but so much of performed music now is done with the drummer having some kind of time reference in his ear because things happen at certain times. If you're doing Twist and Shout, when are you going to ever need a click track, you know?
Yeah.
But if you're doing some 7-minute opus, you know, with all these different parts in it and stuff like that, you know, and everybody has to hit certain marks at the same time, sometimes it's the only way you can accomplish it.
Okay, I get that. I get that. And yeah, and people want to hear the White Album because that's what they're coming to hear.
Yeah, and in the White Album, there's really nothing that can't be covered with this group. I mean, Gil, as I say, he can cover 3 keyboard parts. We've got somewhere between 4 and 5 guitar players. It's not as if we don't have enough hands to play guitar. I imagine anything that was originally, you know, an orchestral instrument, strings or anything like that, that'll be covered by the keyboards. We're not going to carry a string quartet around.
Yeah, they eat too much.
Yeah, they're not worth it.
No.
No, actually, I've toured with the string quartet with Ethel several times, and they're just great people and a lot of fun to play with, and also we're very much aligned in terms of our emphasis on getting kids into music education programs. My foundation, the Spirit of Harmony, is principally focused on helping give people the resources to get music programs back into public schools.
Oh, good for you.
And at an early age and with a formal education, not listening to Cardi B, you know, but actually learning how to play an instrument.
Right. Right, and understanding how it all goes together. I mean, I'm a product of the public schools music system. You know, my dad taught as a music teacher in public schools, and it's made me the listener and, you know, music appreciator that I am today.
Well, that's part of what happens to your brain when you get exposed to music education at an early age. It changes the way you process sound, and that doesn't go away when you get older. So it does make you literally a better listener. You're able to pick out different sounds in a sonically busy atmosphere. You can focus on a person's voice in a crowded room much better because you're able to distinguish the timbres of their voice in the way that you can tell a tuba from a piccolo, you know.
Well, is there a particular song that you are most looking forward to playing from this album?
Well, I've been playing While My Guitar Gently Weeps for literally decades and in dozens of circumstances, so that song was the most obvious one for me to take off the table as soon as I agreed to do this. I said, I'll agree to do this, but I have to play While My Guitar Gently Weeps. It's one of the few Beatles songs that really features a guitar. It's not just simply a guitar solo, but guitar all throughout it. So that's the fun part for me, chance to noodle around and also kind of not simply tribute the Beatles, but one of my principal guitar influences, Eric Clapton.
Well, Todd Rundgren, thank you for all the music, all the years, and looking forward to a lot more music to come and to having you here in Milwaukee.
Terrific. We'll see you in Wisconsin.
Legendary rock musician, producer, and songwriter Todd Rundgren will be at the Pabst Theater in Milwaukee next week with a tribute to the Beatles' White Album. There is a link to more information about the show at WUWM.com. And that wraps up Lake Effect today. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of the show right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It is 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh Air is next.